Fact 7, London Landmarks. This slot is usually quite a revelation to me. I did live on the outskirts of London for 6 years and went up to town frequently, but I've come to realise that there are so many things about our capital city that I just didn't know. This month we're going to hear all about St Paul's Cathedral, that iconic building in the centre of London, whose splendid dome is now dwarfed by all the much taller modern buildings which surround it.
Maybe it's because I'm a Londoner that I love London so.
I'm Sandy Nairn, director of the National Portrait Gallery. When I look at the west front of St Paul's Cathedral, I view it like an X-ray. I look inside the building, at its structure and fabric. I remember how the cathedral has changed since I have known it, and, going much further back, I imagine what stood here before. For 2,000 years, this has been a ceremonial site. The Romans walked up from the river to worship here. Later, there was a spectacular Gothic cathedral completely destroyed by the Great Fire of London. Now, the west front of St Paul's is a momentous classical facade designed by Christopher Wren in the late 17th century. My fascination with the building began when I was a student, studying English Baroque architecture under the renowned Wren scholar Kerry Downes. I studied the complete building accounts of St Paul's. They give an amazingly intimate view of the cathedral's construction, charting the stonemasons, carpenters, and craftsmen employed, and where all the materials were sourced. Before I was director of the National Portrait Gallery, I was deputy director of the Tate and closely involved in building of Tate Modern over the other side of the river. Through this, I was invited to join the St Paul's Fabric Advisory Committee. The committee looks after the fabric of the building, conserving, restoring and adapting St Paul's. That was 14 years ago, and last year I became the chairman. This extraordinary building is therefore very much part of my life. Steps lead up to tall wooden double doors, the main entrance to the cathedral. The doors are at the centre of a tremendous facade of newly cleaned grey fawn Portland stone, stretching 37 metres across. Sheltering the doors is a huge stone portico, two tiers of columns supporting narrow roofs, one on top of the other. The columns tower over us, each one over 20 metres high. The portico itself is topped by a triangular relief by sculptor Francis Bird, depicting the conversion of St Paul in a mass of raised figures. On either side of the columns, high up, there are two Baroque bell towers, and behind the towers, the famous dome. At over 100 metres, the dome is the cathedral's highest point. The whole facade uses classical form to fantastic effect. There are 12 columns in the portico's lower tier, positioned in six closely set pairs, with large gaps in between. Each column is so thick that it would take three people to stretch their arms around one. They're carved with vertical lines bursting with leaves at the top. The platform between the two tiers is decorated with intricate borders, zigzagging lines, leaves and orbs. On top, eight thinner columns continue the upward line of those beneath. They remind me of the ridged metal radiator on the front of a Rolls-Royce, the vertical lines powerful and direct. In contrast to these clean lines, the towers on either side of the portico are flamboyantly Baroque. They're decorated with garlands, cherubs, outlines of columns and arches housing clear windows. The towers stretch up beyond the triangular relief, and the top of each is shaped like a round classical summer house, with its own miniature pairs of columns supporting a bell-shaped dome. Each is crowned with a golden pineapple, a symbol of peace and prosperity. 12 bells hang in the left tower. The right tower houses a clock with golden hands and numerals, its face 5 metres wide. Inside this tower, there's a spiral staircase, designed so that each step rests on the step beneath, unsupported by anything else. Anthony Gormley, the sculptor, was so fascinated by this staircase that he hung a sculpture in the centre, a helix of wire shapes delineating a body cascading through space. There are 7 original sculptures perched along the top of the facade. They are larger than life-size figures. In the middle is St Paul himself, standing facing us at the peak of the triangle. Another 6 apostles are spread evenly across the whole width. Behind them is the cathedral's centrepiece, the dome. It's too high and too far back to be seen from the entrance. Only with some distance can you make out the curving light grey dome with a tower at its peak and a thick golden cross on top. A stone gallery encircles it near the base. Nobody in Britain had attempted to build a dome on this scale before Wren, who realised the sensational impact it would have on the London skyline. For me, the dome's image is overlaid with the famous photograph of St Paul's during the Blitz in a cloud of smoke and dust in the aftermath of the bombing raids. It became a symbol of survival in the midst of that ghastly conflict, not just for London, but for the nation. A semicircle of marble bollards marks out the area in front of the cathedral. Inside the semicircle, there's a statue of Queen Anne, the reigning monarch at the end of the long period of construction. She stands wearing a golden crown and holding a scepter. Her pedestal is surrounded by figures representing the nations of her rule, all enclosed behind a heavy iron railing. Leading up to the cathedral's entrance are immense grey steps, nearly as wide as the building itself. There are two flights, the first of 10 steps, the second 13. To find a handrail, follow the line of the bottom step in either direction. It will lead you back towards the building where the rail is positioned. These sweeping steps always prompt me to ask, how do we invite people into the nation's cathedral, a building intended for everyone? The question was especially pertinent when the Occupy camp took over this area. The protest caused considerable disruption to the building and its work, quite unintended by protesters raising valid questions about corporate greed and power. Initially, the cathedral's response was highly problematic, but finally it got involved in the moral and ethical issues raised, and that engagement has continued. The incident forced the cathedral to consider what role it should now have in the life of the nation. It is not only a historical artefact, it's a living organism. The past and present seem to exist together in St Paul's, and its constant care is ongoing.
Well, that makes me want to go and have a good look around St Paul's. But just don't ask me to go up to the Whispering Gallery, as I have a terrible fear of heights.